Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. World Sight Day, which was earlier this month, brings global awareness to vision impairment and blindness. According to the World Health Organization, an estimated 246 million people live with vision impairment. 36 million are legally blind. And these numbers are projected to triple by the year 2050. According to the World Bank, restoring eyesight is one of the most cost-effective health interventions to reduce poverty. According to the SEVA Foundation, it costs just $50 to restore eyesight. The Berkeley-based nonprofit has been providing sight-saving surgeries, eyeglasses, and other eye care services to more than 40 million people in underserved communities since 1978. The SEVA Foundation says 80% of all vision impairment can be prevented or cured. They say half of the world's blindness is caused by cataracts, a condition that can be reversed with a 15-minute operation known as lens replacement surgery. And according to Harvard Medical School, this simple operation has improved vision in over 90% of cases here in the United States alone. Joining us today to talk about all of this are two members of the SEVA Foundation. Kate Moynihan is executive director of the SEVA Foundation. She is a social justice activist who has created and delivered social justice-oriented programs with a track record of working in places of conflict and humanitarian crises. And Kate joins me in studio. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the show.
Hi, and good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us. Thank you. We're also joined by Dr. Richard Dick Litwin, an ophthalmologist, SEVA volunteer, and lifetime member of the SEVA Board of Directors. Dr. Litwin is an ambassador to eye care practitioners in countries with the highest needs. On behalf of SEVA, Dr. Litwin has traveled to five countries more than 30 times, where he has successfully expanded access to life-changing technology to patients who would otherwise be left to suffer with treatable blindness. He's been a volunteer for 40 years to help eliminate avoidable blindness around the globe. And Dr. Litwin was tapped by the World Health Organization to develop the National Ophthalmic Assistant Training Program in Nepal, India. Hi, Dick. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose.
Thank you so much for joining us. Well, I first found out about the SEVA Foundation earlier this year or last year. The time is escaping me these days. But I moderated a discussion for the group when you brought together board members and doctors to talk about the most effective ways to bring this care to people around the globe. And Kate, I remember being in the room and just wondering, why don't I hear more about blindness? We hear a lot about other diseases, but this is just so important. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, thanks for this. I would agree. I had a similar reaction when I actually put my name in for the position of executive director. I had worked in social justice my entire life. And the more I studied and learned about SEVA, it was remarkable to me that there was this group based in Berkeley that was connected to a network of hospitals and partners worldwide that was changing the world one person at a time by addressing this basic need of a lack of dignity of access to sight, and has an entire approach and way of working with communities that tries to restore that sight for men and women regardless of who they are and what they may do after they get their sight back. It's as close to an absolute good as it gets.
Right. And the numbers are pretty shocking. 246 million people live with vision impairment and 36 million are blind.
That's right.
Dr. Litwin, what are your thoughts? I mean, you've been doing this for a long time. Why doesn't blindness get more attention in the media?
I actually don't know. I operate at the individual and country level and work with people who want to do something about this. The actual public relations part of it is people like Kate do that, and I don't know the reason. Hmm. We're all going to have cataract surgery, you know.
We all are?
Yeah, just about. Because we live long enough, and
right,
the lens ages and gets yellow and brownish, and you get glare, and pretty soon you're in the ophthalmologist's office wondering what can be done. Huh. And great things can be done.
Well, I was also surprised to learn that it costs just $50 to restore eyesight.
Some places.
In some cases, yeah. But inexpensive when you're talking about your ability to see.
Yeah, it's a great bang for the buck. And our partners who do high-volume work in developing countries, they don't take 15 minutes. They take 5 minutes or 3 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So let's talk about where we are right now. Again, 246 million people live with vision impairment. 35 million people are legally blind. And these numbers are projected to triple by the year 2050. Dr. Litwin, is that because we're living longer in many parts of the world?
Yeah. The aging population are the people who have cataracts, macular degeneration, glaucoma. There's also a diabetic retinopathy epidemic around the world. More and more people are becoming diabetic.
Right. So these numbers are going to triple. 2050 is not that long from now, Kate.
Yeah, that's part of what we've been working on as a team over the last couple of years, or actually for the last couple of decades, to be honest. It's a lot of times expressions of solidarity from the states results in people putting expertise on planes and sending it into communities. And it comes from a very nice generosity place of love and such. But at the end of the day, it's not really a sustainable way of engaging and kind of addressing an issue. The model that SEVA purports and works on is a partnership with organizations and communities worldwide where we train local men and women to actually be part of the work that Dick and other doctors do. And it's a whole new industry of people that are mid-level. And so part of that speed that Dr. Litwin had just talked about is the fact that men and women from the community are actually trained to help support those surgeries, help support that process, so that more than hundreds of people on a given day, like a World Sight Day experience, can actually get their sight back at the same time. And so our approach is really this interconnected between focusing on kids, focusing on technology, focusing on the local solutions, and then training that allows us to make sure that not only are we addressing the needs of today, but then it's positioned to take care of the conditions that are coming at us in the future.
So we can talk about Cambodia as an example. When you began working in Cambodia in 1988, the entire country had only 5 ophthalmologists.
Mm-hmm.
And now, not only have you increased SEVA staff based in Cambodia, but as part of your work, you're also training ophthalmologists to perform life-changing surgeries like cataracts.
Yeah, that's something that I think Dick should.
Well, I just wanted to address the idea that more money needs to go into this sector, and obviously that's true. But even with money, because of the nature of the diseases, you have to have staff.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have money can buy equipment. Money can help you build a hospital. But let me give you the example of Nepal, which was the first country SEVA tried to do something with. We started a national blindness program, and a wonderful woman named Nicole Grasset was running it. She went to the country and saw what they needed, and they needed tremendous numbers of personnel. There were already 6 eye doctors for, I think, 16 million people, so we needed some eye doctors, but who was going to take care of all these patients? It takes, you know, half a dozen staff members for each ophthalmologist. So she decided she would train them. She found high school students that had graduated and seemed the right kind of people. And she wanted to send them to our first partner, which was the Aravind Eye Hospital, which was already a booming hospital in South India, and for 6-month training. So it was going to take at least 6 months before the first assistant would be available. The government had other plans. They had adopted a training scheme where it was going to take 3 years. They wanted to send them to college to learn basic sciences. They wanted to them to be able to become ophthalmic assistants. But then if they wanted more training, they could become a nurse, and more training, become a doctor. great system. It's what they use in Australia. But imagine being given all the blindness in that country and wanting to do something about it and being told that your first assistant would be able to help you in 3 years.
Wow.
So there's a lot of politics and there's a lot of just strong-willed people that need to buck the politics.
Do you know what explains the government decision there?
That's what they did. You know, it was a primitive country that opened up. They got help from Australians, and Australians want to do a very good system. That makes perfect sense. But not for a brand new blindness program. You know, you could have put it off 3 years, but think of yourself sitting in a little office above a bus depot with fumes coming in the windows and being told that, no, 3 years is better.
Mm. So what ultimately happened?
She was able to push through a six-month training and get to work.
Can you talk about your personal experiences when you are with someone who regains their sight? You've got some amazing videos on your website, and it's really incredible.
Look, I'm getting teary while you're talking. No matter how many of these you've done, especially when we do eye camps, there, for some reason, in developing countries, people get cataracts earlier. So you'll see a woman, maybe 40 years old, with a child she's never seen.
Wow.
I'm a little choked up, but I remember taking the patch off one woman. She was holding a baby, and a big tear rolled. She didn't have an expression on her face, just a big tear rolled down. Tell you the truth, I cannot shut my eyes and pretend to be blind. I can't do it. I choke up, I get teary.
What about you, Kate?
Yeah, those are the stories that are happening hundreds of thousands of times all over the world because of the kinds of, well, frankly, it's the labor of love from our partners and people in the field. I remember when I first came, one of the stories that I was told was of a single father in the Himalayas called Sunga, and he had several daughters, but he could only afford to bring three of them in for the eye care. And so I think there was some kind of a discussion amongst the family, and they decided that the youngest daughter was going to be the one that stayed back. And the story that came forward was how the Save a Team on the ground actually hired a motorcycle to go and get that fourth daughter.
Wow.
And bring her in. And as you listen to these stories, you think also about the times, too, about all the people, whether it's the granddaughters or the sons or the daughters, who are not living their own lives because they're taking care of that person in their family who can't get to the market or can't work. And that's a whole nother set of numbers, a whole nother set of lives impacted. So they go on and on and on. Last year I was in Guatemala visiting our partner there called Visualisa. We went up to the El Patan, and there was this mother-daughter combination, and the mother was very reserved. The daughter was very open and talking to folks and very engaging. And at the end of the day, we asked the daughter what she was most excited about. We asked the daughter to ask the mother what she's most excited about now that she can see again. And the mother's response was, she's looking forward to getting a boyfriend. So you have that yin and yang of these profound moments and then these very human moments.
I have to tell you one more. So it's the same situation, eye camp. This time it's two elderly, wrinkled people, had hard lives, and the woman has in each eye a ripe cataract. The pupil is white. She hasn't seen anything in years. Same situation. You take the patch off the next morning. She looks around, and she looks at her husband, and people say, "What do you think?" She says, "Boy, is he ugly." That's a true story.
Wow.
And it goes on and on.
Right. Can you tell us more about the eye camps?
Well, we don't do as many of them as we used to because we built hospitals and transportation and screening camps and buses. But years ago, basically that's what you had to do. And especially in Nepal where we started, where transportation was very, very poor. So a typical thing is to go to a high mountain place in a jeep with a lot of equipment and packed with ophthalmic assistants and one or two surgeons. And the local people, they have Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and religious groups. They have been working to spread the word that come to the schoolhouse at a certain time and you can have your blindness corrected. There's a collection of people that have walked for a week. There are always several sons that have a basket on their back that contains their father or their mother. There are also when you wake up in the morning as a doctor, you go out of the building, and before you are a dozen fathers squatting, each with a blind child. And the pity of it is it's not cataract. We can't fix it.
Mm.
It's the cornea, the front surface of the eye has turned white from vitamin A deficiency, from measles.
And you have to tell them that?
Yeah. They can't understand it, the primitive people, so they will always come to the next eye camp. Because the doctors come out of the sky, who knows what magic they might have. You know, years later, when we became more sophisticated and we had hospitals, we started to develop corneal transplantation in these places. And that it's a great effort because you have to have not only surgeons, you have to have a source of eyes. You have to develop an eye bank. You have to develop public awareness so that people will be willing to donate their eyes. And eventually that gets done everywhere.
Wow.
That's part of an initiative that was begun by SAVA back in 2006, Dr. Suzanne Gilbert, at something called our Global Sight Initiative. And early on, where I think we started to focus our work was around access and capacity, because the same report that you referred to earlier, Rose, that talks about the tripling, also talks the fact that there really has to be this sustainable effort on the ground in the communities where folks are working. And she began this thing called a Global Sight Initiative, and that was a partnering so that there could be shared learning, so that what we learned in Guatemala could be shared with our partners in India, vice versa, and work that we're doing here in the States can be shared as well. And we've moved away from eye camps, were more mobile efforts to sort of bring access to places where there wasn't access to health care. And what's evolved from that are these things called primary or vision centers, which can be in a school or a library. They're basically an opportunity for mostly women who don't get to travel all the way into hospitals can come to these centers and have a trained technician that we've helped to train assess where they are and then make a referral to go back into the hospital or to help make a plan for them to then get into the hospital or get treatment on the spot. It may be a pair of glasses that they need or just an eye exam.
Today we are talking about what it will take to ensure that people who are visually impaired or blind get the life-changing treatment needed to restore their sight. 246 million people live with vision impairment. 36 million are legally blind, and these numbers are projected to triple by the year 2050. And today we're talking about the life-changing work of the SEVA Foundation. They say that 80% of all vision impairment can be prevented or cured. Kate Moynihan is executive director of the SEVA Foundation, and Dr. Richard Dick Litwin is an ophthalmologist, SEVA volunteer, and lifetime member of the SEVA Board of Directors. If you have any questions for our guest today about vision impairment and blindness, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall at kalw.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. Where is the need the greatest at this point?
You know, I'm actually reflecting on that question, Rose, because that's something that we think about a lot as an organization. There's clearly larger population areas where there's an increased need because there's just the numbers and the people. But there's also an increased need because of the remoteness. And I think we struggle with this here in the States, whether you're talking about Alaska or even Eureka, right? Where when you can't get access to your care, it doesn't matter sometimes what country you're in. So I think there's an access component to the answer to that question, as well as the sheer numbers. And we try and actually address both of those by making sure that 80% of what we do goes to where the number of people are the most, because that's what it is in part. But we save 20% of our work to make sure that either our time or investment is going towards places because it's the right place to go or because it's the most difficult place to reach.
I wanted to say something else about the SEVA Foundation. So you pointed out that the problem is vast. And SEVA is small. It's small now, but it was in the beginning very small. And we looked for innovative ways to be a catalyst, to make things happen in a quick way. When the organization was founded, ophthalmology was going through a big change in the way we treated the main eye disease of the world, cataract. Up until that point, doctors used to take out the cataract, which left an eye that could just see fingers in front of your eyes. And until you put on thick glasses that made everything swim, you really didn't have sharp vision. And that was a big problem in developing countries, because you would do all this, you'd give people glasses, and they would break or they'd lose them, and then they'd be blind again. Hmm. About that time, the developing world created lens implants, tiny little lenses that are like a contact lens that you put into the eye, in the pupil, after you remove the cataract. And at the time we were starting our programs, those lenses cost $100. Totally impossible for developing countries and public health programs. And so SEVA did a totally, to this day, innovative thing. They bought an intraocular lens factory, and they brought it over to our partner hospital at the Aravind Eye Hospital, put it in the fourth floor, and they made them for $1. And that made possible all these millions of cataract operations that have been done since that time. And these people essentially have normal vision, sometimes better than they ever had. And that factory today has expanded, and it makes 3 million implants a year, which is about 12% of the world's lens implants.
That is amazing. So I have to wonder who set the price initially.
The factory that makes it is a subgroup of the Aravind Eye Hospital, and they are you talking about the price in America or in
just the $100 price?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the price of anything is what the public will bear. I mean, is it worth $100 to have your vision back? So price is $100.
But it would be also fair to say that it was a real proof point around that triple bottom line about doing good and doing well, right? And even to this day, SAVO will be invited. That's part of what you were invited out to see at the Johns Hopkins Institute. We were being solicited for our advice on how do you bring a moral voice to pharmaceutical development or these kinds of advancements so that it's not just about a precious few having access to something, but how do you help control some of the production so that you can control some of the distribution and the pricing? And this particular partner in India was very committed to making sure that it was going to be affordable, that part of the end game for them wasn't just about production and making money, but it was about production and getting a product out to as many people as possible at an affordable price. And that's actually the space that I've seen SAVA show up, the innovative space that I've seen SAVA show up time and time again in the past couple of decades.
We're going to take a quick break. Kate Moynihan is Executive Director of the SAVA Foundation, a Berkeley-based nonprofit dedicated to transforming lives by restoring sight in communities with little or no access to eye care. Since 1978, they have provided services to more than 40 million people. Dr. Dick Litwin is an ophthalmologist, SAVA volunteer, and lifetime member of the SAVA Board of Directors. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. 1A talks with presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke at 11 o'clock today, 1.5 hour from now, here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about what it will take to ensure that those who are visually impaired or blind receive the life-changing treatment needed to restore their sight. 246 million people live with vision impairment around the globe. 35 million people are legally blind, and those numbers are expected to triple by the year 2050. Today we are talking about the SAVA Foundation, and they work to restore eyesight. Since 1978, they have provided services to more than 40 million people in underserved communities. Kate Moynihan is Executive Director of the SAVA Foundation, and Dr. Dick Litwin is an ophthalmologist, SAVA volunteer, and lifetime member of the SAVA Board of Directors. So we were talking about the fact that approximately it costs $50 to restore eyesight. In some places it's less, in some places it's more, but it's very inexpensive. So why can't we just find the money to do this? I mean, it sounds, we're not talking, I mean, there's so much need around the world right now, so much need here in the Bay Area, but we're talking about eyesight. So what's going on here, Kate?
Yeah, we wonder the same thing. I mean, part of it is that when you're in the social justice space, you're spending so much of your energy doing the work and trying to make sure that you're doing the work at the top of your license, at the best that you possibly can. And maybe we had to get better at storytelling or sharing this information. I think that was something that we recognized. But more recently, what we also began to wonder about was, what if we could develop like a real proof point, a real example of what can happen when the right amount of resources are linked to, you know, trying to prevent and solve avoidable blindness. And we worked with our partner in Guatemala, it's called Visualisa, and we determined after doing a lot of research and soul searching and reflecting on it that we actually think that this is a country that we could prove that you can end it in our lifetime within a reasonable period, 10 years, and set up the structures and the systems and the monitoring of all of it, and then take care of the cases that come after. And then that can be a blueprint for the rest of the Americas. And so we're hopeful that maybe by having an example, that might actually help to kind of shed some light on this. But I don't really know I think that trying to help people understand that this is really real, I think maybe that's another element of the space of healing or social justice, that it's almost a little too good to be true. You know, you don't have to pass a test. You have to get access to where we give your care. But once you're there, nobody's asking, well, what do you plan to do when you get your sight back? Are you going to be a doctor? Are you going to be a poet? Are you going to go get married? You're free to go off and have a lousy day, you know, or marry the wrong person. You're free to go off and have the dignity of a life lived by being able to see what's in front of you. And sometimes you're looking for that second shoe to drop, and there isn't a second shoe. There is the really that ultimate good around you deserve to be able to see if we can help you to see, and this is a program, and these are systems and partners that can help make that happen.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm just thinking right now that we're talking about other countries, developing countries. You know, it takes someone who wants to do something about misery that's going on with people they don't know, and they're not their same nationality. It's a certain open-heartedness from donors, but also it's not easy to find doctors in other countries or politicians in other countries who feel the same way about it. These are hard places to live, and people are quite content to just get out of their own poverty and have their own medical care. And they're not thinking about the vast masses of others that don't have those advantages.
What has your experience been like in working with other governments?
I think it's been both.
I'm sure it's all over the
map. I was just going to say, it's right. Exactly that. It's all over the map. I think there are examples with tremendous partnership and tremendous inclusivity and being able to work together to identify national health strategies. And I think we're fortunate that we are part of different international associations like the IAPB, which is a platform that sort of addresses things at a very large level. I would say, you know, the other element too is that we'll have good relationships with certain governments, and then they'll go through elections, and then we find ourselves rebuilding that. So that's not always a fixed mark for us. But it's been a mixed bag. But I do think it's helpful. I mean, I would like to know what you think, Dick, but I would say that for the most part, the fact that it is something non-controversial, that for the most part, coming in and trying to have a solution around sight is, while it may not be the top of everyone's list, I don't think it's a divisive, you know, it's not a divisive reason for wanting to work in a community and to help a partner execute what they do well.
Well, it must be very hard to run a government. And there are governments that don't run very well. And we were very fortunate with our first project. The head ophthalmologist in the country of Nepal was the Queen's ophthalmologist. And he said yes, so the Queen said yes. And we had permission to build a hospital and to have a central office and assist all the other hospitals. Still, to get something through customs was a whole different matter. You know, there would be an airport, and you could come to get your equipment, and it would be in a huge pile. You know, you'd have to sort through the boxes. It's just not an efficient system that you can easily work with. Their hearts were in the right place.
Has the UN taken this up? I just keep thinking about these various conferences where all of these countries are in attendance, and 35 million people legally blind. Okay, so let's say 246 million people who need some kind of help with vision impairment. Obviously, in addition to those individuals, you need infrastructure, clinics, doctors. Mm-hmm. So that's a fair chunk of change. But for the world that we live in, it's not that expensive, given what countries spend on military budgets. And I just keep thinking about weapon systems.
Yeah.
Right?
And it also didn't make it. They had a whole bunch of millennial goals that they set forth for themselves. And this didn't make it in there. So I think that that's an interesting, you know, aspect to it. So education got in there and some other dimensions of dignity. But I don't think that this is something that has successfully kind of risen to that level.
The UN is not a funding agency. They may give you their blessing and they may pay for the salary of a person. But they're not going to fund the Nepal Blindness Program or any other program.
Right. But, I mean, they can facilitate the conversation.
Yes.
I'm thinking about the climate fund, basically. That's what a lot of people are talking about right now. Why can't we have a cure blindness fund?
Right. There are other – I think that that's a very good question. And I'm wondering, you know, I don't know all of why it hasn't reached that level of coordination or that level of advocacy, because you're exactly right. That would be a perfect that would be a good platform to try and at least call attention to it, to get some shared guidelines around ways forward. I know that there are big funding opportunities. The UK has a catalyst fund for blindness, and it's going to be raising billions, if not millions, if not billions of dollars for that. So there are individual philanthropy efforts for it. But in terms of identifying it as a call to action across different countries and communities, it really hasn't gotten that kind of momentum.
Let me tell you about one good thing that has come from WHO. The hospital that we work most with, our basic friend in India, is the Arvind Eye Hospital. And at one point, they decided to build what is essentially a small university right across from the hospital to train whole staffs from other Indian eye hospitals and other hospitals around the world in how you run an efficient eye hospital. And there are lots of eye hospitals around India that were not performing very well, and there still are. And their staffs are being encouraged to come to what's called the Lyons Arvind Institute to be trained. And people from the institute go out and make field visits. SEVA supports about 10 excellent hospitals, mostly in India. And they are mentor hospitals. They send consultants each to about a dozen other hospitals in their area that are not performing as well. And what we found is that with 4 years of mentoring, you can double the output of a hospital. And that's one of our programs, which is an innovative program. It's, you know, it's like the barrier to getting lens implants. Let's just make them. Mm-hmm. And here we're sending out trainers from the hospitals that are operating at a high level.
You did some work. You've done a lot of work in India.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. And you worked with an ophthalmologist, Dr. Sanduk Ruit, to help initiate the first...
That's Nepal.
Oh, Nepal. The first intraocular lenses factory known as IOL. Can you tell us more about that?
All right. Well, there's a little confusion. The first IOL factory was the one I told you about that SEVA did for India. Dr. Ruit is a Nepali who was trained in Australia. There's a wonderful international ophthalmologist called Fred Hollows, who is now passed on. But Fred was kind of a socialist, and he felt that the means of production should be in the country that you live in. And so he funded, it's actually a fascinating story. He had cancer, And what he did when he got basically his death notice, he hired a publicist. And he raised about $7 million through his advocacy and as he was dying. And he left the Fred Hollows Foundation, which is a big player in the world today. And they funded three IOL factories, Vietnam, Eritrea, and Nepal. It's still the pride of Nepali manufacture.
Well, you know, the other thing that goes through my mind when we're talking about this is you talk about the foundations or the wealthy or institutions that give a lot of money to various organizations, and they always want some sort of return on investment, right? That's what it is. This is huge. I mean, in addition to tackling poverty, can you talk about the other benefits? I mean, we're talking about getting your eyesight back. There are just, the list is so long.
Yeah, the list is really, unfortunately, very long.
Because you were talking earlier, Kate, about how it affects your family, but your larger community.
Mm-hmm. And we just also talked about the UN. I should also say that WHO does produce a vision report every year. I think so I just want to quickly correct and make sure that I'm understood around. There is work and effort, of course, from the UN. It's just the leadership in terms of making it something a little bit more on a, you know, at a higher level. That's right. Here's something that's from that report that I think is, you know, people with vision impairment experience higher rates of violence, abuse, including bullying, sexual violence. They're more likely to be involved in accidents. They can find it more difficult to manage their own health conditions because they can't do something as simple as read the labeling, right? So once we start to unpack all of this and you realize that it really is essential to, it's a cornerstone to human dignity. And when it can be restored, it's a biblical proportion, right? And so those are the stories. And that's why, you know, we were talking, trying to help bring to the imagination of whether it's people here in the States or even in the communities where we work, this idea that this young guy will carry his mother for 4 days on his back, 4 days over mountains. This was told to me by our gentleman who's a photographer for us. And he saw them come into the camp. He had to put her down every few hours, feed her, lift her back up, continue on the journey. The parting image that this colleague of mine has is after this eye camp experience, and it was a sunset, they're leaving the village together, side by side, shoulder by shoulder. And I thought to myself, how do you help explain the dignity that that mom now has, where her son doesn't have to carry her someplace? She's capable of getting there on her own. And then that means she can go to the market. She can do her own work around the house. She can go off and work in the community if she wanted to. But these are now things that are possible that weren't possible before. And that's what I think is maybe part of the challenge is, like, how do you – there's such a universal truth to all of it, and yet at the same time it really requires – I think what Dick was saying earlier, it requires that open mind, that really big open empathetic heart to just imagine for 1 minute that you couldn't see or touch or go and do the thing you wanted to do most in the world.
I have an anecdote that illustrates this. The first trip I took in 1982, I went to the Arvind Eye Hospital. The director there, an incredible human being, Dr. Venkateswamy, saw me put in the first IOL, the first implant in a patient. So this man was a carpenter, and he developed cataracts in both eyes. Previously, they would have taken the cataracts out, given him a thick glasses, and he would not be employable. He saw me put in one implant. He looked at it and he said, "That man can work. That man can pay us back for the implant." And a few years later, they built the factory to make those implants affordable.
Wow. Today we are talking about the work of the SEVA Foundation. Kate Moynihan is executive director. Dr. Richard Litwin is an ophthalmologist, SEVA volunteer, and lifetime member of the SEVA Board of Directors. We have a couple of emails. Bob writes, "Bravo to the SEVA Foundation and to Dr. Richard Litwin for their work. I have been a patient of Dr. Litwin's for many years, but I only learned about his work with SEVA in the last few years. I can appreciate the impact more as my own eyesight has deteriorated. His work is so beneficial, and he is doing it when he might have been long retired. If only some of our defense spending could be diverted to this worthy cause."
Thank you. That's my sentiments.
Thank you, Bob. Greg writes, "The story about buying the implant factory and selling the implants for a dollar instead of $100 is telling for the entire pharma industry and the U.S. economic model that encourages funding and enabling ruthless greed is the best way to run a society." Kate's arms are up in the air.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's possible. There just has to be that combination of will and commitment.
Wow.
Yeah.
What can we do to raise more awareness about this?
I think, you know, at the risk of, you know, stating the obvious, I think the chance to come and tell a story on this kind of a platform with you, Rose, is really meaningful for us. I also think that we need to find ways to be a little bit more dogged about getting this issue up on larger platforms so that maybe along the lines of what we were talking about earlier. Regarding the UN and such, because with 2020 coming at us, I mean, for me, it was such a natural lightning rod year for us because of what that means, you know, in our lexicon about perfect vision. Although Dr. Larry Brilliant will tell you that there's even more perfect vision out there. Babe Ruth might have had it, for the most part, we are trying to do what we can in the next year and a half to 2 years to try and bring this attention to more people, and to see if we can't be a really big part of leading the parade on ending this in our lifetime.
And can you tell us just how you all operate and how you raise money? I should say we posted a great mini documentary about SEVA on our website, and some of the great Bay Area band members have been involved over the years. I mean, it was really great to see how SEVA came to be and all of the very good people who've been doing this great work.
The SEVA lore and the origin story is pretty magnificent. It has Dr. Larry Brilliant and Girija Brilliant, Wavy Gravy, and his outstanding partner and wife, Jahanra. You have Steve Jobs being one of the first donors to the organization. And then you have a great story about Wavy, who's from the Woodstock days. He got on a plane and convinced the Grateful Dead to do a concert. And then it became, when I joined, the team affectionately refers to them as the house band. You have Bonnie Raitt, who's a wonderful artist, and Jackson Brown and Joan Baez, who have all dedicated their talents and their love of humanity by raising money for us through their concerts. And they've done it without receiving a penny. So it's really well before even the We Are the World that happened back in the 80s. These artists were out there.
Don't forget Ram Dass.
And then, of course,
he had an incredible part in building this organization. For maybe 3 years when it looked like we would financially go under, he and the people who supported him went to his talks and lectures, and he donated all the money to SEVA, kept us alive.
Yeah,
to fight another day.
Harvard Business School talks about what's needed for a good startup. And you have to have multiple, like making sure it's men and women and different age groups and different disciplines. And SEVA had that in abundance between the spiritual leadership, the doctors, and the ophthalmologists that were involved at the beginning.
Undisciplined comes to mind.
I think that's the reason why it's fun to work here.
Well, we talked about how these numbers are going to triple by 2050. 35 million people today are legally blind, and that will triple. In the United States, 75% of adults use some sort of vision correction, like eyeglasses or contacts. 60% wear glasses versus contacts. But as we were talking about earlier, we're aging, and I feel like my eyesight's changing because I look at the darn screen too much, especially the phone, although some doctors say it doesn't really affect your vision. So you've got that. And then we've done shows, but we need to do more, about just how ableist even so-called developed countries are. At places like New York, San Francisco, public transportation systems are not equipped or advanced enough to fully accommodate people who are blind or vision impaired. I remember on a trip to New York, I was surprised because I couldn't find any escalators or elevators, I should say. And I thought, I saw these people with these suitcases and moms with their strollers having to go up these steps. And I thought, what about people who can't see or can't take the stairs? So what are your thoughts about what needs to be done to better serve people who are visually impaired or blind?
Well, politically, I can't comment, but of course, you know, I'm impressed with the things that have already been done, curbs that are easy to walk over. But we have a whole specialty in ophthalmology and optometry called low vision. So for the people who have some vision, there is a whole technology that's being developed, lenses that can magnify without distorting, better lighting, optical cameras that can read a book for you, and a lot of cleverness from the technology world is going to making people who have some disability more functional.
And just quickly, we're almost out of time, but Martin just called and said, why is cataract surgery so important and urgent?
Well, the reason, in an individual, it's not urgent. But the whole population, as they age, are getting all the diseases of aging. And in the eye, the most important one is cataract. And so if you don't set up a system that's able to handle that in your geographic area, you're going to wind up with a lot of people who are blind, who don't contribute, who absorb resources, and it's unnecessary. That's what we're about.
And just quickly, Dr. Litwin, if we're talking about, say, a child who has blurry eyesight and doesn't have access to care, does this negatively deteriorate the eye or put more strain on vision as time goes on?
In some cases, it can. Most of the kids who are nearsighted equally in both eyes just have trouble with the blackboard, and that's one of the common refractive errors. But if there's a big difference between the two eyes, the brain will pick the clearest image and let the other one fade away from disuse.
Dr. Dick Litwin is an ophthalmologist and SAVA volunteer and lifetime member of the SAVA Board of Directors, and Kate Moynihan is Executive Director of the SAVA Foundation. Find more information about their important work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
That was wonderful and quick.
Thank you.